We have hundreds of eyewitness accounts of how Dublinists responded during Easter week, and in general there's huge hostility. But at the same time there's a wide range of responses. Like one of the first really visible responses you see in the streets of Dublin is hundreds of kids coming out to loot shops, steal. Within a few hours that turns into something a bit more menacing, with people breaking into pubs and drinking and so on, it's rather chaotic scenes. The other scenes that we see a bit, particularly by the end of Easter week, is huge public displays of hostility towards the rebels. I mean, in some cases, the rebels have to be protected from the people by British Army soldiers.
And when did it all turn? I mean, it started to turn when the British over-responded in a way, didn't it? But was there a sort of a tipping point when people went, no, hang on a second, actually what they're doing is something we support?
It's actually quite gradual, because one thing you see during the course of Easter week is they hold out much longer than most people expect, and there begins to be a bit of, not sympathy, but a kind of grudging respect, and sort of they're putting up a good show. And there's also, of course, always pockets of people who do support them, but most people don't. Then within days of the rising coming to an end, the executions begin in batches of 2 and 3, and that's when opinion really begins to turn. But as well as that, there's also the huge amounts of arrests. 2,500 people are interned, 3,500 people are arrested, and that really begins to turn opinion when you think about all the families and waves of friends that spreads out from.
Yeah. And was there a difference in terms of religion or social status or class in terms of how people responded? Because, I mean, you're here in Christchurch, so you're looking at the Church of Ireland. I mean, did the Church of Ireland respond different to the Catholics? Did middle class people respond differently to working class people?
Yeah, we're here in Christchurch. I'm going to be talking about Anglican perspectives in particular. But I would say that class and geography were the biggest single factors. So, for instance, in the centre of the city where the rebellion takes place, most of the people who live there are very, very poor. The wealthier people live outside of this, so they have a very different experience of rebellion and the hardships. Class is very important. The rich and the middle class are kind of insulated from the from most of the problems, particularly food shortages by the end of Easter week. But then, of course, religion is important, because most Protestants are unionists, so there's a stronger sort of sense of identification with the British Empire, with Britain, but also, of course, with the soldiers who are fighting. So you definitely do see, almost even place by place, you can see changes. Like Trinity College is loyal, Guinness are loyal. You know, so there are these interesting kind of micro differences within the streetscape of Dublin.
And of course, the rebels themselves were very intellectual, weren't they? They weren't really working class. They were very, they may not have been wealthy, but in terms of education, they were very much coming at it from a intellectual, abstract, ideological perspective.
Well, if you look at the leadership of the rebels, they certainly conform to that idea of poets and playwrights and so on. But actually, most of the rebels are working class or lower middle class, and they don't necessarily have exactly the same ideas as you find in the proclamation. I mean, a lot of them are maybe more Catholic working class nationalists, for example. So the whole range of different viewpoints, everything from republicanism and socialism to the kind of Catholic nationalism, which becomes much more obvious feature of the Irish state after independence.
Yeah. And did people join in as it got going? I mean, did it start with one group and then other people said, well, I'm gonna join in here, I'm gonna start fighting on one side or the other?
People joined in the looting. They didn't join in the fighting, unfortunately. And people like James Connolly, socialist revolutionary, very disappointed that there wasn't a different response from working class Dublin. People joined in spontaneously in demonstrations against the rebels, shouting at them, attacking them, and so on. Very few people actually joined in the fighting, which is quite interesting and does give you a sense of the public mood at the time. Another group of people who do join in are all the rebels who thought the rebellion was going to be on Sunday and then thought it wasn't going to go ahead on Monday, and then they find out later in the week and they join in. So you do get, it's a dynamic, fast-moving situation.
How should we look at it today? Because it wasn't something that was welcomed, and if we were to see that now in another country, we probably would condemn the people who are doing it and think, well, you know, there's other ways to go about this. There's political ways to go about this. There's never an excuse to create chaos in a city. But on the other hand, because we have the sort of hindsight, we see it as kind of a largely a good thing. But how should we commemorate it now, 100 years later? How should we look at it 100 years later?
Well, I think the first thing to say is we should look at it today in its historical context then. And that historical context is framed very much by the wider First World War. So it's almost, we can almost see what happens in Dublin 1916 as a battlefront of the First World War, and it has to be seen in that context. And I think you need to be very careful about comparing it to conflicts which come much later, even if people would claim the same legitimacy for that. So I think that's one kind of perspective which we could apply to it. The other thing that I think we should do is look at how it's commemorated over the past century. So from the 1920s and 1950s, we had a very simplistic, heroic view of 1916. It was all, the rebels were all good. And then the Troubles, there was a long period of kind of embarrassment. And I think actually the current phase of remembering is much more interesting because we're going back to 1916 and we're looking at some of the voices that were kind of written out of history afterwards, like, for example, the role that women played or the role that socialists or other kind of radical elements, because they were aspects of the rising that weren't remembered by a sort of a conservative nationalist state for many decades afterwards. So I think we're actually writing back into history, and that would be what I would emphasise. We need to look at it, go back to the original sources and look at it in its historical context, while also remembering it in a way that's relevant to the present day. And that means, for example, being a lot more inclusive about, for example, the role of women or what happens to Irishmen who are fighting in the British Army or in the police, and thinking about it in terms of how we've moved on politically in the current day.
And were there conflicts? Because obviously there would have been people who would have been fighting in the British Army, Irish people fighting in the British Army, and I presume they would have been part of the British Army that came over to suppress the rebellion.
Most of the British Army who came over during Easter week were English, but most of the people who respond first to the Easter Rising on Easter Monday are Irish, or many of them are Irish, and a lot of the people who were killed in the first few days in British Army uniform are Irish, and certainly in a number of cases there's brothers against brothers. So it's quite complex. But of course, some of those wouldn't necessarily be completely hostile to the rebels' cause. I mean, most Irish nationalists in the British Army were nationalists, so there would have been a lot of ambivalence, but a lot of them would have felt with the World War I and what's going on in the Western Front that it's certainly not the right time to have it, while others would have felt much stronger and would have felt that what had been organised was really a stab in the back. So there's a really wide range of responses from Irish soldiers in British Army uniform.
Yeah. Although I suppose it was also very opportunistic. I mean, you strike somebody, if you've been trying to rebel against a particular country for a while, you strike while they're weak.
Yeah, from a Republican point of view, there had to be a rising in a time of war. Otherwise, they would have lost any sense of credibility. There was the hope that they would have some kind of significant German support, the arms shipment we know about. But I think what was particularly important was the idea that for to keep republicanism alive, you had to have a sort of an armed insurrection. And that even if that armed insurrection wasn't successful, and most of them knew that it wouldn't be, that when the war comes to an end, a lot of them thought Germany would win, that Ireland would be in a good position. So there was quite a complex range of sort of motives, and very few of the rebel leadership would have had any serious belief that an immediate military victory was possible. But they would have believed that they could really transform popular opinion, which of course they succeeded in doing.
Yeah. I mean, that does paint them in a different light and makes them seem like martyrs to the cause, because they knew it wasn't going to work out, but they went ahead with it.
Yeah, the idea of martyrdom is a bit tricky, because for a long time we had this idea of Patrick Pearse and the blood sacrifice. And, you know, some kind of Catholic nationalists kind of liked that idea. It was quite powerful in the 20s and 30s and 40s. But, of course, for other people it meant that these people were like zealots or even like fascists. But actually, historians are now more emphasizing that there was quite a rational thinking behind a lot of the Irish Republican Brotherhood in particular. So Pearse didn't organise the rebellion. He was the figurehead of the rebellion. The IRB organisers they were revolutionaries. They had a pretty hard-headed sense of what was possible.
And some commentators as well have said that they feel like religion is being written out of it, that we're looking at it almost from a secularist perspective, and we're not appreciating how tied up in religion and how religious the people who are partaking in the rising were.
I think we have always, looking back in 1916, we've always found the rebellion we want. So from the 20s to the 50s, people looked back and saw a very Catholic rebellion. And then that's become increasingly unfashionable. And now there's a tendency to look back and see a very secular, very radical rebellion. And the truth is that the rebellion was all of these things. So if you look at the proclamation, it's a very radical document. It's got elements of it which are very typical of modern republicanism and secularism. But at the same time, if you look at how the rebels actually behave and what they do during Easter week, it's much more complex, because in the GPO, and in fact in almost all the garrisons, the rebels are saying rosaries. They're going to confession. There's a deep sense of a kind of a spiritual Catholic resurgence during Easter week. So it's quite a complicated thing. And you're also looking at different groups of people. So earlier generations of Fenians would have been Republican and they would have been secular, and they would have regarded the Catholic Church as an enemy, and vice versa. But the generation of Patrick Pearse and so on, the cultural nationalists, were much more into a sense of identity that was based on the Irish language, but also for some of them, like Eamon de Valera, Catholic identity. So you're looking at, again, a wide range of different kind of philosophies, and that idea of a Catholic Gaelic state is one that emerges from the Rising most strongly.
And it's the one that, in a sense, we had that became our legacy.
Yes, it's the one we had, and it's the one that then, in the last couple of decades, we started to get fed up about. So we're now having other ones with very radical women, for example, and so on. And I think that's fine, because those people did exist, and we need to know about them. But we need to sort of have a kind of a degree of balance, and it certainly is the case that in some modern accounts, the very strong religious dimension of the Rising is being a little bit underplayed or written out of it.